I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. By any standard, Scott Stossel is an overachiever, editor at The Atlantic, author of two books, and a writer whose work has been published in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, among others. He has also, for most of his life, had crippling anxiety with debilitating fears of everything from separation to public speaking to cheese. His new book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, is part personal memoir and part historical survey of anxiety, its causes, its symptoms, and its cures. The book is published by Alfred K. Knopf, and I'm so glad it brings him here today. Welcome to The Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you for having me.
You have a description in the book about your pre-public speaking regimen. What does it consist of, and did it happen today?
Good question. I write in the book about how at events where I am liable to be particularly anxious, it requires a sort of beginning several hours in advance, beginning to take benzodiazepines, which are an anti-anxiety drug that sort of slows down the firing of neurons in your brain. And then when I'm at my most anxious, I will sometimes, and this is, I'm not a doctor, and if I were, I would not recommend this, and any doctors listening would not recommend this, but I will sometimes combine that with alcohol to take the additional edge off. So in full candor, I did take my usual complement of Xanax before our meeting today, but I did not partake of the vodka, so I hope I'll manage to stay coherent and not overly anxious here today.
Oh, we appreciate that. Vodka keeps coming up on the show today. So Joan Didion famously said in Blue Nights that alcohol has its own well-known defects as a medication for depression, but no one has ever suggested, ask any doctor, that it's not the most effective anti-anxiety agent yet known. Is that true? No doctor's ever not suggested that, that it works on anxiety?
I don't know if no doctor's ever not suggested that. But there's a funny story I came across while researching the book. When they were looking at some of these cutting-edge remedies for anxiety that were being developed in the 1950s, and when they were coming up, and I forget which one specifically it was, whether it was Miltown or one of the early benzodiazepines like Librium or Valium, he said, this is great. It has the same range of indications as gin. So there are overlapping anxiolytic qualities to these things.
Let's nail down some definitions to start.
Sure.
When we talk about anxiety in 2014, what does it mean, and how is it different from fear?
I spent a lot of time in the book wrestling with questions of the definition of anxiety, and it's hard to pin down because if you look across history, the definitions have evolved over the years, and in fact, technically, what we today call the anxiety disorders didn't even exist until 1980 with the publication of the DSM-3 manual. That's the sort of Bible of the American Psychiatric Association. And before, people tended to use Freudian terms to describe what we now call anxiety disorders. They were referred to as neuroses or psychoneuroses. But fundamentally, and you know, again, there are definitions that are all over the map, but the one that I tend to like to use is one that one of my therapists gave to me, and he in turn was borrowing from Darwin, but it means, you know, anxiety is a feeling of dread about events that we are helpless to prevent. Darwin distinguished that from despair, which is saying, you know, when you are afraid of something, you feel anxiety. When you have no hope of relief, you feel despair.
So anxiety requires a hope for relief?
Or a prospect of the future. It's something upcoming. My definition of it, I guess, would be is that, you know, the fear response, the fight or flight response, as Darwin first identified it and other doctors have studied it since, is an evolutionarily adaptive human response to danger, and it you know primes your body to be able to more effectively flee if that's what's called for, to fight if that's what's called for, in some cases to pass out and faint so that your blood pressure drops and you don't bleed out. Again, in the state of nature, if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, or if you've been you're confronting a hostile tribe, this is a highly adaptive thing. With people with clinical anxiety, or when you're in the throes of a panic attack, what tends to happen is it's a misfiring of this normally adaptive fight or flight response being triggered at the wrong time, or being triggered disproportionately to the level of anxiety that you should have. So basically, you know, anxiety disorders are, you know, people who have clinical anxiety have debilitating levels of anxiety that impairs their performance. some level of anxiety, some level of, you know, having your adrenaline pumping is adaptive. And in fact, back in the, about 100 years ago, there were these two Harvard psychologists, Yerkes and Dodson. They developed what became known as Yerkes-Dodson law. And if you picture kind of a bell curve with, you know, going from left to right, you've got level of anxiety, and going vertically, level of performance. If you're too far out on the right side and you're too anxious, your performance will be impaired because you're too distracted and your body's misfiring. But if you're too far over on the left and you're not anxious enough, you'll also be sort of enervated and you won't perform optimally. Where you want to be is at the top of the curve, where you're a little bit anxious and you're engaged and your senses are all firing. So the right level of anxiety properly harnessed is highly adaptive.
That has not always been the case in your life.
That is true.
You have some incredible stories you tell in your book, with some with great flourish and humor, but I'm sure were just humiliating and shameful feeling in the moment. Let's start by just talking about your wedding.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been talking about, if you're chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you were at the altar marrying your bride.
Yeah.
What was happening?
Well, actually, there was a saber-toothed tiger at the wedding. and so actually it was totally excusable. No. Basically, I was standing up there. It was legitimately hot that day. But as I walked out in front of, we had probably 250 or 300 guests. Beautiful day. I'd been very excited about getting married. This was not sort of wedding, traditional wedding jitters. This was purely, I'm in front of all these people. I'm having to perform. They're all looking at me. I'm starting to feel anxious. And again, this is a very sort of typical progression of anxiety symptoms. I was feeling hot because it was legitimately hot in the church that day. But I start to sweat. And then I start worrying, boy, is my sweating visible to the people who are looking at me? And then I get more nervous, and then I start to shake. And then by this point, you know, my wife-to-be has been brought up to the altar, and I'm sort of leaning on her, and she can feel me, you know, shaking, and she's sort of holding me up. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is going to be so humiliating. I'm going to collapse in front of all of my friends and family. What are my peers going to think? What are my wife's or one of my in-laws-to-be going to think? This shows he's not worthy of marrying her. And then my stomach starts to hurt, and I start worrying about that, and I have a whole host of sort of phobias relating to my stomach. And so basically it was, you know, it felt like years, but it was, you know, 20 minutes of just struggling not to pass out, not to, you know, sweat through all of my clothes. Actually, I failed at that. And, you know, finally, you know, I managed to get through it, get out to be successfully married. But, you know, then sort of beat myself up over it afterwards because I was not at all present in the moment. I was just sitting there trying not to have a complete breakdown in front of all these people, which I thought would be sort of a terminal humiliation.
So you were an adult at that point, but this is something you've been feeling since you were a kid. How is it different as an adult to have these intense anxiety episodes versus when you were seven and not really sure what was happening?
Well, it's interesting because you would think, or I would have hoped, that particularly now, you know, in the course of writing this book, I spent, you know, upwards of 8 years reading everything I could get my hands on about the history and science of anxiety. And I know, you know, everything there is that a non-expert could know about the neuromechanics of a panic attack. I know what the physiology of anxiety is. I know the thought processes that lead to it. So sometimes I'll end up in a situation where I'll start to feel a little bit anxious, or my body feels somehow not right. And I'll start to wonder, geez, is this a panic attack, or am I sick? And then, you know, I try to talk myself down, saying, you know, it's just a panic attack. You know, you've had thousands of them. You know how this works. And much of the time I actually can talk myself down from those, but sometimes I can't. The difference when you're a little kid is that you have, and this is fairly typical. I mean, my first anxiety, starting when I was a very little kid, had to do with acute fears of separation from my parents. That then developed into other phobias and sort of social anxiety, which was not, you know, completely atypical of being, you know, sort of a dorky adolescent. But it could be quite miserable. I mean, I spent, you know, many days at the when I was in school, I would, you know, develop psychosomatic headaches or stomach aches, and, you know, end up going to the nurse's office and wanting to go home. When I ended up in middle school, which was really sort of the nadir of my anxiety, where I was just, you know, acutely anxious. This is when I finally got prescribed sort of heavy duty medications, Thorazine, which was a sort of antipsychotic of choice at the time, and Valium, and other antidepressants. I would end up, you know, I'd get a stomach ache in class, and I'd end up having to go to the nurse's office. And this is, I'm in seventh grade at this point. All of my friends are wondering, like, why is Scott wandering around, you know, with the nurse all day instead of going to class? But I managed to get, I mean, you know, it was very close that year to maybe, you know, dropping out of school or ending up being committed. I got through the school year, and I think that was very important to my sort of, you know, continuing to on through a normal life.
So I want to talk more about drugs versus sort of mindfulness about what's happening mm-hmm. in your brain. But first, on that seventh grader who didn't want his friends to know what he was doing walking around the halls with his nurse, my favorite parts about the book is you talk about talking to your therapist about your anxiety, about writing your book about your anxiety, and your therapist says, well, why don't you write about how right. you feel anxious about your book about anxiety, and you include some of those writings. How do you feel now that you're talking publicly and have told these stories about what has happened to you at your wedding and other crazy stories? How does it feel?
Very good question. The short answer is mixed, but mostly on balance, good. And it helped that, you know, we published an excerpt of the book in The Atlantic, which was kind of like ripping the Band-Aid off because
a cover story.
Yeah. Well, and also that section, you know, what we published in The Atlantic was sort of the distillate of the full crazy me. So once that was out there, you know, there's other stuff that reveals, you know, other elements of the crazy me. But
did you fight really to hold back some of those stories, or did they?
I had some trepidation, I confess. It does get easier. And I mean, one thing that has been important to me, let me back up, actually. So while I was writing the book, it was easy for, you know, I'm sitting there in a room by myself. Struggling to try to make the book fit together. There were times when I thought I couldn't pull it off. So I'm imagining, like, this book is never actually going to come out. So it doesn't matter what I write. Nobody's actually going to read it. And then suddenly, you know, here I am, putting this stuff all on display. And as you noted, you know, I talked to my therapist, Dr. W, in the book a lot about this. And he said, you know, put it out there. It might be, in effect, like coming out, as it were. And you could find it to be therapeutic. And it has been quite heartening. I mean, the responses I've gotten to the article and to the book, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people coming out to say thank you. A number of other people coming out to say, wow, we had no idea you were so crazy and this was going on in your head. But that's been very, to some degree, liberating. The sort of unfortunate irony is that, you know, one thing that people with various forms of social anxiety fear is to have undue scrutiny directed mm-hmm. at them. And, you know, I could hardly have done, and they're particularly worried about, is their anxiety going to be detected? I could hardly have done anything more assured of guaranteeing that people are going to be looking at me like, is he anxious, than what I have done, which is publish a book about how I am anxious. But so far, so good, though.
Some of those stories include a gastrointestinal adventures at the Kennedy compound where you run into JFK Jr. We don't have to go into the details on the radio. Look it up in the book, folks. But it was interesting, me reading it. I was thinking, oh, it's going to be cathartic for me to read that someone else feels. I haven't struggled with panic attacks in the same way that you have, but just the general feeling of when you feel overwhelmed with anxiety. But I found that I couldn't read your book right before bed.
Yeah. So I was just saying before I came in here, I've had a few people tell me that they're reading the book. I probably shouldn't say this because I'm trying to get people to read it, but they said that it made them weep and gave them a panic attack and that maybe it should come with an FDA warning. But in the main, most people, I think, if you are someone who suffers from anxiety, the overwhelming response has been that this provides some solace and consolation and some feeling that people who suffer from this are not alone and that it is possible to function and even thrive despite it. And for people who don't suffer from it, I think it provides first of all, I think anxiety as an emotion is provides real insight into the human condition. I mean, I talk a lot about the sort of philosophical theories and approaches, religious, psychological, physiological. I mean, it is a way of looking in multiple ways at kind of what it means to be human. One of my friends said after she read it, she said, you know, I read half the book half the time I was thinking, wow, I can relate to this and I can relate to that. And I wonder if my son has that. And the other half of the time she was saying, boy, thank God I'm not as screwed up as he is. And I think most people will fall somewhere on that continuum.
We'll talk a little bit more about how this plays into the overall human experience after the break. I'm speaking with Scott Stossel about anxiety, both how we view it and how we treat it. His book is called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. It's published by Knopf, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Anna Sale in today for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Scott Stossel. He's the author of the new book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. The book walks through the great mysteries of the source of anxiety. Is it physiological? Is it a collective angst churned up by the times? Is it genetic? What do you think about your anxiety? Where do you think it comes from?
Yes, all of that. I spend a lot of time. I mean, basically, I go through in a series of chapters, in effect, kind of trying on different theories for what the cause of my anxiety might be. So I have a full chapter on, you know, was it my upbringing and the you know, sort of particular parenting style that my parents had, you know, particularly my mom, who was given to, you know, somewhat extreme overprotectiveness. Was it, you know, something to do with my early childhood experiences, as Freud would have said, or, you know, was it genetics? And in my family, there is a fairly long history. And the more I looked into this, the more struck I was by how kind of stippled with anxiety my family line is. So, you know, there's myself, my sister, now my kids, which is sort of heartbreaking and fascinating to me. My mother's mother, my mother's grandfather, who in the 1940s had been for a long time the dean of Harvard College, where he was a very successful, upstanding member of the community, and basically had a series of breakdowns that landed him in McLean Hospital and undergoing electroshock therapy for basically what was acute anxiety and related depression. So I read this with sort of great kind of haunted recognition, because, you know, I read his case files and a lot of his thought patterns and sort of his situation, you know, having a kind of outwardly status-bearing job and yet sort of having an internal self-image that is greatly at odds with that. And I read this and think, oh, my God, you know, am I destined to this kind of – so where I come down, though, after, you know, just based on my own personal experience and after reading fairly widely on this, I am convinced that there is a very strong genetic component to one's basic – predisposition to anxiety. And that is to say, you know, people fall along a spectrum, and some of whom are, you know, incredibly resistant to being perturbed by stress, say, you know, 20%. And then there's another 20% on, you know, closer to my end of the spectrum where, you know, the psychologist Jerome Kagan, who's studied this for 60 years at Harvard, talks that they're people with inhibited temperaments are more prone to be shy but also to develop anxiety and depression later on. That is sort of hardwired into your genome or to your genotype. And, you know, there's thousands of studies sort of starting to identify individual different genes that contribute to this or that element of anxiety. But all that said, you know, that kind of baseline level of anxiety may be pre-programmed, but overlaid on top, the danger is to succumb to this kind of notion that genes is totally destiny and that you are doomed by your genes. That is not at all the case, and I don't believe that at all, because overlaid on top of that are absolutely things like your upbringing, your parents, whether you experience trauma, luck, circumstances, you know, how you're able to develop, you know, resilience through your own experiences, sort of overcoming your anxiety. So you know, genes are in no way like fully determinative, but I do think that there's an underlying component. And you mentioned culture. And I was fascinated in researching this book that everyone sort of assumes that this age that we're going through now is an age of anxiety. And I think that's true. But you have to be chastened a little bit, because as you go back and read about each preceding generation, you know, whether that's going back through generations of the 20th century or going back to Victorian England or Georgian England or the Renaissance or the second century AD Rome, all of these, you'll find doctors and social commentators saying, you know, never has there been an era so, you know, totally ravaged by anxiety. So it's sort of a self-flattering diagnosis. But I do think that there's pretty compelling evidence that certain eras are more producing anxiety than others. And those eras tend to have a few things in common. You know, rapid change, sort of social upheaval, rapid technological advance. And nowadays, too, you know, we have tons more free choice than, say, our ancestors in the Middle Ages would have had. That's a net positive thing. We have more choice about what breakfast cereal to buy when you walk in and have 57 choices in the grocery store. You have more choice about whom to marry and what job to choose and what personal style to adapt. But all that choice is also somewhat anxiety producing, because, you know, you have to make decisions and you could be wrong. And there's also a profound amount of uncertainty in the culture today. You know, obviously, the economy has been rough for the last 5 years. We've lived through terrorist attacks over the last 15 years. And there's some research suggests that literally the emotional experience of uncertainty is directly tied to anxiety. And if you experience it chronically, it may actually rewire your brain in such ways that you feel even more anxious. So if we live in uncertain times, it's making our brains feel uncertain and more anxious. And then it becomes this sort of self-reinforcing cycle. And, you know, no wonder we're all running around, you know, having panic attacks and unable to sleep at night.
And speaking of choice, you also have some choices about what kind of treatment you seek for anxiety. To be clear, what is your current diagnosis in terms of your mental health?
I mean, I have been diagnosed with different things depending on, you know, because the sort of terminology and the diagnostic categories change. I mean, basically, I have panic disorder with agoraphobia. I have a few simple phobias of things ranging from cheese to vomiting to flying. And then sort of specific social phobia pertaining to public speaking. And for the range of recommended treatments for all of those things is all over the map. And you'll find plenty of people who say, you know, drugs are by far the most effective means of, you know, treating the symptoms of these, if not, you know, even addressing the underlying condition. And for what it's worth, I have sort of experimented with multiple medications over the years, some of which have worked. But, you know, my belief is that they do work for some people sometimes, sometimes with, you know, bad side effects. There are those on the other side of the spectrum who say that drugs are absolutely evil, that the pharmaceutical companies are sort of profit-minded, rapacious, greedy, you know, corporations, and that in fact all that they don't work, and to the extent that they do work, they're just masking the symptoms of the underlying anxiety. And if you're taking drugs, you're preventing yourself from treating the underlying anxiety. I fall somewhere in the middle. A lot of the emerging evidence in controlled double-blind studies suggests that something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is very effective for treating anxiety and depression. Basically, that's a form of talk therapy, but highly concentrated on trying to get an anxious person, say, to expose themselves to the thing that they're anxious about, whether that's flights or heights or subways or enclosed spaces, and learn to adapt the feel and to the fear, and also to reframe their thinking and to you know, take on more adoptive or adaptive thought patterns that don't lead them down a spiral of anxiety and sort of self-loathing.
And you have a whole period in your book where you describe seeing two doctors simultaneously.
Yeah.
Who one is a fan of drug treatment, one is a fan of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's Dr. Harvard versus Dr. Stanford. And they fundamentally disagree about what's the best treatment.
Yeah, no, when my first book came out 10 years ago, I was feeling acutely anxious about having to go on a book tour then, and I was already seeing sort of one principal psychiatrist, but I was like, I can't handle this. I need more help. So I went both to Dr. Harvard, who is a psychopharmacologist, who was saying, look, your problem is a biomedical malfunction. Uh-huh. It's like diabetes. You need to treat it. And then I went to Dr. Stanford, who's a cognitive behavioral therapist, and she said, no, these drugs are preventing you from directly confronting the anxiety. You need to stop taking it. And so I talk in the book about how, you know, I'm seeing both of them, and you know, I felt so bad for Dr. Stanford when I told her that I was still, you know, resorting to the Xanax, that, you know, I thought she was going to cry. So I stopped telling her about this. There's also a funny story actually that recently updated now. So I talk in the book about how Dr. Harvard, as evidence of his kind of relentless focus on the kind of biomedical approach. Uh-huh. He actually, I read in the paper while I'm getting treatment from him, that he's actually treating a gorilla in the local zoo with the same kind of drug cocktail that he's treating me. And it's funny. So in the magazine article, I report that the drug didn't work. I hadn't heard from Dr. Harvard for 7 years, and he wrote me a very nice letter.
Dr. Harvard recognized
himself. Dr. Harvard recognized himself. He said, I'm not sure that it's me, but there are only so many gorilla doctors in the Boston area. And he wrote me a long note explaining that actually there was one monkey who they couldn't cure of his violent tendencies. A whole bunch of the other ones worked with a combination of benzodiazepines and SSRIs, and in fact cured some monkeys of trichotillomania, which is a tendency to pluck your hair out. And all of them are now drug-free and cured. So that's a pretty strong argument in favor of, if you're a gorilla and you're anxious, you should see Dr. Harvard.
So the story of your assorted treatments is really fascinating to follow. But I wonder if, when you look at your kids, you mentioned that you're seeing some of the same symptoms in your kids.
Yeah.
The ability to kind of accept that maybe there's not a cure, that must be more difficult when you're looking at your kids.
Yeah. I mean, it's It was sort of, as I say, it was sort of heartbreaking when my daughter, when she was seven, which was more or less the exact age I was when I started developing the acute phobias, suddenly developed the same phobia. And having, you know, I was deep into the research for this book already, and, you know, immediately we got her in to see a psychologist who actually helped a lot. And, you know, for me, writing the book was trying to come to terms with the notion that, you know, some component of anxiety or an anxious temperament is woven into me. I can never necessarily be technically, you know, cured of it, but I can manage it, and I can you know, recognize that there are adaptive qualities associated with it. But yeah, seeing it in my kids, you know, I do where the book is, you know, I dedicate it to for Martin and Nathaniel, you know, may you be spared, because I would, you know, just as soon they be able to avoid what has, you know, beset me and my great grandfather before me. It also, you know, I talk fairly candidly about some of the things that I, in my parents' behavior, that may have, you know, contributed to my own anxiety. It's certainly a humbling and chastening through realization that, you know, here I am, having read all this, being incredibly well informed about anxiety, and yet these same things are cropping up in my kids. So, you know, it gives me more sympathy for my parents, who did the absolute best that they can and were, you know, very loving parents. We are very loving parents and are doing our best, but this is where the genetic component, I think, becomes sort of maybe not completely addressable. And probably too, you know, my anxious behavior, as much as I try to conceal it, does come through it to my kids.
Your book's called My Age of Anxiety. We talk about the age of anxiety all the time, as you already mentioned. Having gone through this and suffered, do you kind of take umbrage to when it's kind of thrown around, like, of course everybody has anxiety, everybody's high anxiety, and not really, you know, acknowledging that some people struggle in a different way?
I don't take umbrage, but I do see what you're saying. And I mean, there's two completely kind of almost opposite problems. And one is that because of that there are now all these drugs to treat various forms of anxiety, I think there are people who may not necessarily need those drugs, who are not truly clinically anxious, who get sort of swept up in the drug company nets and end up being prescribed for things that are probably just normal vicissitudes of living. You know, the people talk about the worried well. On the other hand, I do think that there are vast numbers of people who are suffering with these kinds of disorders. I mean, the estimates are that it's, you know, one in six American adults at some point will struggle with one form of anxiety disorder or another. And many people are simply not aware of what they're going through, are not aware of the ways they can get help, and particularly among the poor, where access to mental health services is maybe harder to come by. And so, one, you know, this is not why I set out to write the book, but I do hope that you know, if people read it or talk about it, it helps people who may be struggling with this and not know where to turn, what the resources are. You know, there is an organization called the Anxiety and Disorders Association of America, ADAA, and I recommend anyone who, you know, might be listening now or and feels like they have unbearable anxiety or know someone who does, it's a good resource. They're agnostic in terms of what approach works. They'll just try to hook you up with you know, resources that'll help you find the therapist or treatment you need to get better.
So at this point, having written your book, telling your story in quite a lot of detail,
yeah.
You talk about your wife looking at you and saying, I wish you didn't have to suffer through anxiety, but I'm afraid you wouldn't be the same person I love without your anxiety. Do you feel that way?
I think it's possible. I mean, and she said, I think the direct quote is, you know, I worry that if you weren't, you know, if you didn't have your anxiety, you might actually turn into a complete jerk. And she and she pointed out that I'm still kind of a jerk. It's just I'm not a complete jerk. And I might become one if I didn't. I don't know. Other people have asked me that. I mean, maybe it's rationalization. And, you know, I like to think that the things that the positive things that my anxiety provides are things like a more socially, you know, attuned antennae ability. I mean, I've talked to therapists who say many of their clients are lawyers, and the best lawyers are worried lawyers because they're worrying about every possible eventuality. But there are certainly ways in which for instance, my anxiety makes me a worse husband or a worse father because my life is constrained. There are things I can't do, and being liberated from that would be very helpful.
Scott Stossel, the author of My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.